90.7 FM on the dial in Mount Lexus. I wish we had something like that in Kentucky. Don't forget to vote, y'all.
Basilica Farm and Flea Holiday Market is back Black Friday weekend, November 28th, 29th, and 30th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. Visitors can play, learn, eat, and shop with over 120 local farmers, chefs, makers, and collectors of the Hudson Valley. Info at basilicahudson.org. See you there.
Wedding list.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Bell and Abigail of Hudson, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
This is Rob Lumberg of Uncontaminated Sound. Today's guests, I have novelist Julian Tepper on. Apologies. Yes, today I have Julian Tepper on. Novelist of four books, the 2012 title Balls, the 2016 Arc, 2020 Between the Records, and 2014 novel Cooler Heads. Julian, welcome to Uncontaminated Sound on WGXC in Catskill and Hudson.
Thanks so much, Rob. Really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me over.
One second.
And I'm a big fan of the station. Are you having a...
Hello. It seems not getting any audio. Testing. Let's see. Sorry, Julian. Hello. Testing, Julian. Hello.
Oh my! I'm being told that they can hear you.
Oh, apologies to my listeners. I couldn't hear any feedback in my space. Well, apologies for the listeners out there.
I've got some friends and fans tuning in. They've told me your tech is fantastic and you have nothing to worry about.
Julian, welcome to Uncontaminated Sound. Well, this is why I call it Uncontaminated. You never know what happens on air, and just
wouldn't be the first on air tech issue.
No. So welcome to my little studio world right now. and where are you coming in from? New York City, I assume, right?
I'm in the city. Yeah, I'm in a neighborhood called LIC. It's kind of like it's directly adjacent to Greenpoint, like right across from the UN, 42nd Street.
Oh, nice. No, I love LIC. I volunteered from 2020 onward at Culture Lab, if you know it well.
I do. I live just around the corner.
I love that area. It's such a great great neighborhood and just the vibes and just affinity for that creative culture lab there. So it's I know that area well.
No, I was going to say that I've been here 15 years in the same apartment. Yeah, so I've seen it. I've seen it come along.
Yeah, no, it seems like, you know, all the high rises and the development in the neighborhood, it seems like it exponentially kind of grew from, I'm sure it wasn't that developed in, early 2000s, but it's
Yeah.
So I'm a bit tossed off my game here, but to wax poetics, I guess to start, how did your creative journey begin? How did you get into writing and your creative path? What's your story, I guess? Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to definitely credit my parents, who are both artists. My mother's a jewelry designer. My dad's a musician. So it was a creative household. We were sort of encouraged, but also surrounded by and having models. And I say we, my brother and I, because... And my grandparents too, and both my grandfathers painted very, it was a way of life for them. So it was part of the inheritance, really. And I was certainly as with my dad a lot in recording studios growing up and just sitting around in my mother's office watching these things get made. And so there was a lot of intense boredom, and that all sort of played into the creativity for, you know, no question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you grew up in, New York City, correct? I guess, how did the city play into your, like, creative energies, and, like, how did you establish, like, from being a transplant myself, from Boston and transplanting to New York City, it was a different vision, and, you know, maybe I had kind of like the metaphorical idea of New York City, but growing up in New York City and being a city native, like, did you have that kind of poetic vision of the city, or how was it, I guess, in that perspective?
That too is part of the inheritance. You know, if you you grow up here and it's your home for one thing, but also the city is very important to my family, to my mother, to my grandparents, to all of us really who spend that kind of time here. But my great grandmother was born on the Lower East Side. My kids are fifth generation New Yorkers, and we spent a lot of time thinking about the city and looking at the city and being out in the city, and it just, for me and my work, it was, you know, it's a crucial piece for sure. You know, it is the main, generally New York City is the main character in all my novels.
Yes. Yeah. When did you start writing, I guess? Like, when did you start into the craft of writing?
Yeah. I would say I became very serious about it in college. But the first time I wrote, I have a sort of strange, almost an origin story that sounds, it sounds like almost unbelievable, because it's exactly what I'm still doing. But it sort of happened one day. I was in my mother's office. So my mother had a jewelry company on 47th Street with her two sisters. Probably about 15 people worked for them, and I would spend a lot of time there after school, summers, summer jobs, and I would sit in the front of the office with the receptionists, basically. And my mother and her sisters, hugely talented as far as designs and their business sense, but they were vicious to their employees, Rob. I mean, just now. And I was up there, you know, seeing, you know, I was sort of experiencing it alongside of them, but outside of them, because there were no consequences as far as this wasn't my livelihood, and I didn't have to, I had the option to, no one was mistreating me. But one day I just started writing about my mother and her sisters and the office and just changing names slightly, and telling the story of the office. I think I was about 11 or 12. And then I finished the story, it was written on a typewriter, and then I read it to the women at the front of the office. And it was a very important moment because they were all, you know, to use a term from our this time, they all felt incredibly seen because the story was about just how vicious my mother and her sisters were towards their employees. And, you know, it was a comedy. And sort of playing on just what I found to be sort of shocking behavior from my family members.
Interesting.
Rob, this is what I'm, you know, it's 34 years later and it's, you know, I'm making the same thing really. But that was the first time I wrote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know why I decided to write it as fiction, but I did.
Well, I feel like you could step away from your actual self and kind of, you know, dramatize and make it more funny, your life a bit more characterized if you turn it into fiction comparatively to a nonfiction. What were you reading at the time? What were you influenced by, like culturally, or like on the literature side as well, the stories side as well?
No, I mean, I was reading literature in school. I think, but I was really sort of intensely like an MTV kid. It was music, it was videos, it was records, and books sort of came a few years later as far as just sort of truly taking over for me. But yeah, so to this day, I'm still confused by why I sort of thought to write this piece. But yeah, that's what I was, you know, film for sure. Television. I mean, I was raised by a television, no question.
Yeah.
That's how the time was spent.
Yeah. And now it's for today's generations, it's the internet. And sorry, I'm so it's funny to think about how your childhood dictates your future self. And like, I've gone through that process of chasing my creative path a little later in life due to me myself reflecting back on my childhood self and my imagination going wild and being creative explorer. And I was always into novels myself or reading as a kid, and also of course some TV and movies and stuff like that. But it wasn't until like I hit New York at like 31 where I was like, oh, this is you, that you can actually pursue this creative pursuit in a serious manner. And it's been a crazy journey on my own accord. So I, you know, I'm not here to talk about my path, but I find it funny that New York City was the fire starter, I guess, to open myself up to my creative, prowess, one would say, and take it in a serious manner, where from my home state of Mass, that it was never really considered that. It was like I pushed aside a bit.
And I think even for those people who are born here or come here, finding that this thing that you're describing is sort of taking this at a level with a level of seriousness and making it, if that means making it professional, or how you get on that track. It's not something that anyone, there's no manual for that, and I think everyone sort of struggles to figure out what that means. Even it's kind of funny because I had these models in my home, but for me the real model was that when I graduated college and I had a manuscript written, but I had no idea what it meant to be a writer, to become a published writer. You know, I was 22 and still very much figuring out how to write, honestly. And I was still a long way from figuring that out. But my brother and I and our friends started a band, and for about 4.5 years, I did that. And that's where I sort of learned everything about the professional side, the sort of the amount of work that goes into it, the discipline, the all of it, you know, dealing with that awful word no.
It gives you
sometimes no thank you, realizing that that's very much a part of the whole journey. Yeah. and sort of also understanding how unimportant a no is.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So
and that band was Natural History, correct?
It was called the Natural History. Yeah. And and we were very serious about what we were doing. So and I was learning a lot from the people around me, and that's when at 26, 20 years ago now, I shifted, let's say, back to writing.
Yeah, yeah.
But decided to do it professionally. I felt like I knew how I could get there, whatever that, you know, however long that took. I sort of had a sense that, okay, well, if I do A through Z,
yeah, yeah,
it may just turn out all right.
Now, were you in school? Were you studying writing, MFA program?
That's what I did. I did not get an MFA, but I went to school for, I went to undergrad for, okay, for lit. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And regarding process, did you pick up what did you pick up from like undergrad school, comparatively just going out and experiencing life and developing characters that way? Or I was going to ask you, I guess, like, have you found a lot more influence from just going out and living, comparatively to trying to workshop things and to really be overly, literally, critical and, you know, and technical, I guess.
I mean, discipline being one thing, which I'm happy to talk about, but I think it really comes down to reading, you know, and yeah, to seeing what great literature looks like.
Yeah.
And getting to a point of your understanding of that. So that's where the bar gets set, you know? I mean, it doesn't mean you're going to get there, but yeah. It's, and it's, it can also, it's, I can be inspired by my peers and things that are coming out. But generally speaking, I think reading great books was where I got a sense of where it has to get to,
yeah,
as far as
yeah,
things concerned. And I don't know, we have a lot of disciplined people in my family, you know. I mean, my mother's father, I give him a lot of credit. My second book, Arc, is inspired by him. He is the title character. And very serious about painting, and really I gravitated to him a lot as a kid, and he really spoke to me a lot about, yeah, you got to wake up and do this every day.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you're just not going to get very far. Doesn't mean that's the answer to everything. I mean, you got to learn what's the right way for yourself, but yeah, I mean, he used to say to me literally as a kid, you get out of it what you put into it. It sounds like, you know, a cliche, but it's just true, you know. So if that time and dedication is crucial. Yeah. And then with my, you know, I think with music, what was really important you can see how you can really track your development. You know, you're putting in this time and you're seeing yourself become, for one thing, a better player.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you practice your instrument and you get from one point to another. And so I think that when there was a lot of frustration around writing early, you know, I knew that if I just put in the time, I would get there. Just was a matter of putting in the time.
Well, and that brings me to a question I had is, like, how long did it take you to develop your actual voice that people know in your novels now? Like, what was that process like? Of course, we have the discipline in writing and practicing, yeah. But how does one, or as a writer, or even just a like musician, et cetera, or creative, find their creative voice? I know, obviously, it's a broad question for generalization, but in your case, how did you find your actual writing voice, what it is today?
It's a good question, because I definitely early on wanted desperately to find that voice.
Yeah.
Just wanted it more than anything, and felt unsure of how it was going to happen, really. And then eventually it just came. Eventually, just from writing, you know, a long time. It took a long time, and it's not. I think I could be somewhat gentle with myself in developing it, and not be as much as I wanted it, not be so harsh with myself, because I did know that there was going to be a lot of failure along the way, and a lot of sort of despair around when is this thing going to come?
Yeah.
And then it just And it took a couple of unpublished novels and really just also my first novel, I don't think I was there yet, but by my second published novel, it happened, and I don't think I've looked back since on that.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of writing, a lot of years before that came.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's part of it. I don't know. I've also sort of, somewhere long before then, I realized that, you know, don't worry about whose voice you have to use to get there, in a way, you know, sort of meaning like what inspires you to make art in the first place. What, you know, if it's writing, you know, I would find myself at times, you know, writing like my heroes, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to stop yourself in that moment and become, you know, very hard on oneself. But I sort of realized early on that I didn't have to beat myself with that particular stick. I could find other ones, Rob.
Yeah. Yeah. If I may, can I... broadcast a little tune from The Natural History for you, for interrupt our little conversation? Or
what tune are you gonna play?
I was thinking Don't You Ever, or is that,
oh, go ahead.
That,
yeah,
cool, just, yeah, a little refresher, flashback to the Natural History days. And I believe Spoon picked this track up, correct? Or
they did. Yeah they did.
1 second, Julian, we'll get back to conversation in 2 seconds or 4 minutes or so. Or...
yeah.
Don't you ever
That was a clip from Don't You Ever, the Natural History. And just a programming note, breaking the algorithm, IRL is upstairs at the Avalon Lounge, November 20th, 7 to 9 p.m. It's Mike Amari in conversation with Karen Schomer, Day for Nights, Sky Furrows, and DJ set by Iggy Capra. And welcome back to Uncontaminated Sounds with novelist Julian Tepper.
A little Hudson Valley trivia about that song is that it was written in Woodstock, New York.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to the Center for Photography at Woodstock for a while, printing my own prints there until they moved to Kingston, and it's I haven't been over there in a while since I've moved to Hudson. go ahead. Sorry. You're well familiar with the upstate as well, Hudson area, Woodstock, of course. You just mentioned, but
I am actually. About 5 years after my parents split up, my dad moved to Woodstock. So this is the early 90s, and my brother and I, we used to get on, my mother would put us on a Trailways bus at the Port Authority, you know, on a Friday afternoon, which, you know, in the early 90s, I just cannot recommend to anyone. the Port Authority recently, it's not much better, Rob, but it is slightly better. You're not going to get murdered. But yeah, so we would go up there then, and you know, I was a little young. I wasn't too enthralled, but these days I do appreciate it up there. And yes, this record that we made back, we wrote it in 2004. We rented a house for 2 months in Woodstock in the dead of winter. It was like The Shining, but it was just my brother, myself.
That's wow.
I'm Shelley. Yeah. I'm Shelley Duvall. Yeah. I kid.
Wow.
But yes, yeah.
Well, to build off that though, too, like, do you need certain writing spaces to really focus, or like in the city, or in your studio, or I mean, or just a do you have specific places where you can just focus on writing, or?
I think I do. I have an office, and I write there. I like to write very early in the morning. In general, as long as I'm indoors, I'm okay. Outdoors, that's an issue.
Interesting. You know, yeah.
Fly lands on you. The breeze blows. The glass on the sun is in your eyes all of a sudden. These are issues because you're trying to focus. But otherwise, anywhere inside is fine.
Yeah.
But yes, I do have a dedicated space in my home, and that's where it happens. Yeah.
I was just kind of thinking, like, oh, if you guys went up to Woodstock and focused on writing that track, Is that a different process, I guess, than your individual writing, I guess?
Well, I mean, comparing it to, so, you know, different. I have two kids,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I have a 14-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I'm someone who appreciates that pull as far as, you know, I don't, at that time we thought, oh, let's carve out this 2 months, we'll move into a house, we'll just work.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think this is the best way to write a song, although we did write a very song, the song you just played. So, I mean, good things happened, you know?
Yeah.
But mentally, I think putting myself away has never been the best way to get things done. I do like to work first thing in the morning, but I also feel like it's okay knowing that I've gotta drop my kid off at this place and get to the school and do this, and that, you know, I'm gonna write for these hours and then, you know, maybe return for a few more, and that it's not it's like one thing I would tell any aspiring authors, you know, don't be precious about time or space, really. You know, you do it, you know, where and when. But
yeah.
I do feel like isolation is not good for my own creative process. No way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I feel like, I've noticed over a quick review, and I must dive deeper into your novels and into essays as well. But, I've noticed really deeply, based upon relationships, and there's tension between these relationships. And are those characters and relationships kind of based off people and experiences you've kind of built up along the way, I guess?
Yeah, Rob, they are, yes. I pretty much only write about relationships from my own life, whether they're romantic or familial. The inventing on that level can't happen for me at the frequency where you're going to bring a whole novel to life, or, you know, I really, so yeah, so this is where I tap from and continue to. There'll be a new book out next fall, and this is, when I still on occasion try to purely fictionalize, and it's just terrible, Rob. I mean, terrible, just sentence by sentence. There's nothing happening. It's not alive. It's not good. I actually tried it recently, and just doesn't work. But there's stories that I want to tell, and there are more stories that I want to tell. So I keep bringing myself back to the writing table to tell them. And yes, they do involve people from my life.
I had a good question. I guess, like, is there any one interaction you had that, like, was really, like, interesting or just so impactful that you added that interaction or person into a character or a scene in a novel?
Bringing certain, compounding these characters into one, this kind of thing.
Yeah, or like maybe, yeah, I guess so. You're like, could be a culmination of people in your life, or I was thinking of just maybe you had like this really interesting or like funny or dynamic interaction in your life, and it was like, well, I have to write about it or put it into a story.
There was definitely a time earlier in, you know, my life where I was really looking out as a writer at the world, at my relationships, at circumstances, and saying, oh, well, this is going to be this is going to be good to write about.
Yeah.
Now I'm at the point where I'm like, oh God, I'm going to have to write about this. So I'm not looking. These things, they just come for you. You know, I've found myself on this. Yes, it's the other side. You'd rather almost have nothing to write about. I mean, I'm joking, but you get my meaning. You don't really choose these things. They choose you. So in a moment, I don't, I'm not really thinking about those things in the moment, but then in the writing, they might find you. And if it means pulling from something that, happened on one day with someone else, but you feel like it's going to be useful, you use it for sure, as long as it works.
I mean, like, I inquire because it's, being in New York City, you always have engaging or... there's always some kind of interaction with people, be it good, bad, or frustrating or aggravating. It's New York City, you know. So I'm curious if that's kind of also New York City as the character adding to your writing as well. But
yeah, I mean, you know, we've mentioned this beforehand, just these corners, these cursed corners, as part of Cooler Heads that came out last. And this kind of thing, I mean, this is these corners that cycle through one tenant after another and can't maintain one commercial enterprise for any number of reasons. And so this has sort of always fascinated me my whole life. And I was starting to jog a lot around my late 30s, and I was jogging around the city, and I would take a photo of a cursed corner. I would see it would be something that, you know, a location that I had tracked my whole life, you know, unconsciously. I just sort of knew, you know, had been somehow keeping tabs on all of these places and thinking about why they couldn't maintain a business. And I started taking these photos of these places while I was jogging, and I'd write these mini essays and upload them to an Instagram handle that has since been taken down, because now they've all been sort of folded into the most current novel. And so I say that because, yeah, you're always looking for what's working and what's available and what you've been thinking about and people you've been meeting. But I don't, and that was a big one for me. You don't know what you're going to need when you're going to need it in the writing. So certainly in a moment, I don't leave a moment or a corner and think, this one.
Yeah. And that's it.
This is it. Now that scene's going to start. Because even if I did, it probably wouldn't work on the page. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, can you talk a bit about, like, your first novel released, I believe, 2012, Balls? And, like, how did that come to fruition? And then maybe talk about how your newer novel came about. Perfect. And if there's any maturation in the voice and process, I guess.
Yeah. So with Balls, it is an act of mostly fiction. And I think I was just really, really just trying so hard to write a first novel, and really struggling. So, I don't know. I grabbed hold of a subject that it started working. The sentences were alive and the story was happening. And, but it was really, really a hard time. Really hard to sort of figure out what I'm trying to say, who these people are, what did they do, what are their problems, and it works. I mean, the book in the end works. It's a first novel, And, you know, you, I think at that point, you're really just trying to figure out, like, well, can I do this thing? Can I get from the beginning to the end? And is it working? And so that was that process. And now, and since then, I've really just, it's not that I tend to know where I'm going. I tend to know, again, who these people are. And it's not that I don't get off the path, or, you know, and find myself way, way sort of beyond what I'm, where I mean to be. It can happen, but I catch myself. I mean, let's say with that, with the first book, you know, I'd maybe write some 100 pages or more and be like, well, what? This all has to go. It's not, it's not the same book, you know? I mean, this is now, you know, there might be a couple of days where I'm trying things and it's not working. So, I'm much more, just sort of aware of what I mean to say and where I want to take things. And I won't say too much about this next book, but it's called Getting Even, Letting Go. And it'll come out in fall 26, and it's about getting even and letting go, Rob. It's a nice dark New York comedy. It all takes place on one day, and excited about that. I think that was something I always sort of wanted to do, tell a one day story. It's sort of where all my books tend to be between, which is, you know, you should be one part laughing hysterically and also just terrified.
As we should be in life, yes. Yes, I agree. question about, like, the process of, like, how did, like, you had the concept for your first novel. You wrote it out, and what was the process like of getting into a publisher and getting it out there? I'm just curious because I'm super unfamiliar, particularly at like 2012, where it was, you know, internet obviously was there, but now self-publishing, I feel like, is exploded. But super curious on that process.
I mean, it's, you know, it was really difficult. There were, it's a story I tell infrequently, but like to tell because, you know, as you're sort of marking your individual progress and trying to sort of see where you once were and where you've come to, I remember this one really, really awful day and the experience of getting that first book published, which I had a literary agent. He called me one day and, he was like, Julian, I just hate being a literary agent. He says, I can't do this anymore. And I'm sorry, I've tried to sell your book, but I can't. I mean, it took me a year to get him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was wonderful, and I didn't hold this against him. He has gone off since and done interesting things, but he was done. So I, you know, I just remember feeling particularly just awful that day because, as anyone will tell you, especially for a first book, it's just really hard to get an agent, almost as hard as getting a publisher. You know, you got to get someone to read and to love, to want to make a life about, a work life about this particular project. It's a big ask, and so I get why it's that hard. So I lost that agent, and then I came to another one, and she sold the book, and that was the beginning. But it's definitely it's incredibly hard, and something that I've definitely come to understand is that, you know, again, to the young artists out there, never underestimate someone who loves what you do. You know, when you find those people who really really care about your work, want to put it into the world, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Not to be undervalued, taken for granted, none of that stuff. It's hard. Because think about it. Think about how often you fall in love with a book, a film, a song. It's hard to get that. But now imagine you had to go out there and sell it.
Yeah, yeah.
But not just for a day. It's a lot of work. So it's getting someone to that level. It's a lot.
Yeah. I understand that as being a visual artist and a photographer, yeah, and whatever else I am, but creative in general. I had and to build off that too, like how in contemporary digital world these days, and in the just onslaught of content, and now with the rise of AI, how do you compete and work, not even compete, just work around it and stay true to your writing process and your authentic voice, get it through everything out there now, and particularly now with AI.
I think I tend to have this default mode where, you know, I think of how hard it's always been to be an artist. You know, it took James Joyce about 12 years to sell Dubliners. And he was trying.
Yeah.
And there's a million stories like that. It's just always been hard. So no one should feel that a particular time or place is more difficult than it's ever been. You know, you have to really want it. And there's a very large chasm between the people who make things and put them out into the world and keep doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it, and then people who are less sure. I don't know where that gap, what fills it. It's mania, obsession, it's a lot of things, but I don't think that, not that these things that, you know, AI, of course, how books are consumed, how they're made available, and true of every medium. I mean, to think that we live in a time where you can't get people into a movie theater. I come from a time where you had to buy the tickets, like, you know, the day before or earlier that day, because you weren't going to get in and you had to show up early and, you know, you wanted to get the good seat. And now it's, you know, so, I mean, these things are always changing and it's always been difficult and no one's ever had the answers. And the people who put things into the world, meaning in this case, the publishers, it's always been a struggle, and no one knows anything really. So, you know, for me, it's just a practice, really.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think, regarding just like younger generations now, like kids growing up now that want to be a writer, do you think AI is kind of hindering their abilities, or what do you think, or any thoughts on that notion? Or,
I mean, there are going to be people who want to put a book out into the world that badly and use strictly AI, and it's happening now, of course. But the process of starting a novel, writing a whole novel, finishing it, publishing it, I mean, you've tapped into something that is very, very, very crucial to oneself. The idea that, like, I would ever want my sentences to be written by a machine, or that anyone would who's trying to make art, is sort of baffling. I don't know. It's possible we get there where no one wants to make art anymore. That's
that's a dystopian.
One individual soul. I mean, maybe we get there, but it's not. I don't see it as being this. I don't look at the younger generations and worry about them because they're going to have things to say.
Yeah.
And they're going to feel that they have to say it. And that's what they'll do.
And actually, with more tools available to creatively express themselves than we've ever had these days, you know, self-production in numerous manners and in video, audio, you know, digital world can be used as artistic tools these days, just to kind of be devil's advocate in my own conversation. But it would be a day when a dystopian day when there's no more art, you know, in creation. And let's hopefully that never comes, of course. But
we'll be long gone, Rob.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe you'll be plugged in somewhere.
Yeah, hopefully I'll be bot, you know, or just like, you know, cyborg, one would say. Or projected, like my previous self will be just a database of my conversations, which would then live on in projections of different forms. But sorry to go out all abstract and
not at all.
Philip K. Dick kind of esque. we only have a few minutes left. So where, I guess, are you continuously contributing to any essays out there now recently, or where can people check out any current writing or short writings or essays or your current stuff or thoughts?
I would just say get the most recent book. It came out last year for Rare Bird. It's called Cooler Heads.
Yeah.
I think it's the best novel I've written. And now I've just been working really hard on this next one to try to get it written. So that's just where all my attention has been. But you know, read the essays out there. They're out there. I think of them all as you know, they're always, we live in a time where you can have access to anything. So I don't feel like there's nothing disposable about any of it, really. So, you know, Google me, look at the essays, read them, love them, hate them, DM me, and we can talk about it.
Now, do you do any, like, readings at all, or particularly say like your about regarding your 2024 novel, or do you still do that, or was that just for when it's released and marketing stuff?
Mostly just for when it's released. I've done a few things recently. I actually did something up at the Golden Notebook.
Cool.
Which, in Woodstock.
Oh, okay. I'm unfamiliar, actually.
You guys have the was it? It's not the Salty Dog. What's in Hudson?
Oh,
it's a dog. It's some kind of Spotted Dog.
Spotty Dog. Yes, yes.
It's a great bookstore.
Yeah.
I mean, let me, if you're listening, it's truly such a wonderful bookstore. I can just spend hours there.
Well, it helps with the bar there, you know, a bookstore and bar. It's always convenient.
It does help. I like the people who are hanging out. The bartenders are nice. The music is good. The selection is really, really very good.
100% agreed on that. It's also cool to hang around and sit around the bar and pick up local gossip and see.
We'll do that to you for you. It delivers, no question. It is a wonderful small town.
Yeah. I have characters here where I could write about myself So you have in the works, fully just dedicated to the new novel projected to be out 2026, did you say?
Oh, 26,
yeah. I don't even know what year it is. I don't know where time has gone for this year, but
who could say? Hopefully we're all still here. That's it. You know, the publishing process is such a long one, from when you begin a book to even when you turn it in and when it finally comes out. I mean, God, I've had some friends who have turned in books. They've had to wait, especially around the pandemic, wait years for them to. You forget what you even made, who the characters are, the stories, and but there's no short fiction path. It just takes a long time for these books to get not just written, but published, turned around through that publisher's pipeline, and you know. You just hope that everyone's still alive and kicking when the day comes.
Yeah.
So you can go to the bookstore.
Yeah. So any last words of wisdom to any aspiring writers or creatives out there? I'd like to ask that
too. Yeah, I think just begin. Spend some amount of time. It doesn't have to be hours. You'd be amazed by just if you do a little bit of work every single day, what you can amass over time. So I think it can be a very overwhelming when you're standing sort of at the beginning, especially if you've never gotten there to the end before. It can be very daunting and can paralyze people. So it's really just, you know, do it every day, do it for as long as you can, but just show up and do it, and then check in, then assess, because it's amazing what can happen with just a little bit amount of time every day.
Yeah. And thank you for that, Julian Tepper. Thank you for joining me on Uncontaminated Sound. Hopefully it's enjoyable. Yeah. If you can hang on for 1 minute after we go off air, I'm going to close out with a bit more of Don't You Ever.
That sounds like a great idea. Thanks for having me.
Of course.